The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly, and I think you're going to need a bigger pod. Premier League, Leicester bangs, incredible come-from-behind victory over Man U at the King Power. We ask, is King Power the title of an Alan Pardew self-help book? And if Jamie Vardy is fantastic Mr. Fox, is Mark Clattenburg Mr. Fox it up? Elsewhere at the Etihad, Frankie Lampard's story. Former Chelsea star trudges off in self-loathing as only a man who's just screwed his ex can. And with Neil Warnock masterminding a Palace win at Everton, it's a weekend so amazing we haven't even found time to mention Mesut Ozil scoring. There's similar end-of-day scenarios abroad. Newly promoted Paderborn going top of the Bundesliga with an 83-yarder. In Spain, Atletico Madrid slipping again in France, moaning and ill-temper in Paris. I know. And in Italy, there's Florenzi hugging his granny and similar feel-good vibes. We're going to try and fit all that in, plus Dutch news, in this Football Weekly. Hey everybody, an amazing weekend of football. I have to say, today's pod lineup more than does it justice. We've got Jacob Steinberg in.
Hello.
Who's actually been watching the football, so yeah. That's good. Ian McIntosh.
Hello.
That's you, all right. I bet you've got some metaphors up your sleeve, haven't you?
Just two.
Well, we're going to have a whimsy off with Barney Rone, who makes his season debut in the pod today.
Hi.
However, did you escape your Manaus taxi hell, Barney?
Have I not seen you since then?
Nope.
It's still, you know, flashbacks are still there.
All right.
Thanks for all the help, though.
Yeah. There's a film in that. There is, isn't there? One of those kind of Wolf Creek style.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Found footage.
Exactly. Anyway, there's ever so much football to talk about. There is. And we have to begin with the incredible events in Leicester Sunday afternoon. I was following this via the medium of radio. And it sounded absolutely extraordinary, Barney.
It was extraordinary. I mean, I was watching it in quite a strange place. I was in the Manchester City press conference room.
Ah, right, okay.
Watching it with a whole load of kids dressed in City kits who were having a tour. Mm. And also various kind of City wonks and workers and administrators. It was just kind of weird because there was a little bit of crowing. But there was a real sense of things having switched. I mean, it used to be City who were
they embarrassed for United?
It was a little bit of like, what are they doing now? I mean, you look at City and you do suddenly think, oh, actually, things have really switched there. It's such a well-run club. Mm. I mean, you know, they bought Mangala, who made his debut and was fantastic. Mm. And then you look across at United and think, here's a team with lots of strikers. And you kind of wonder who's making the decisions there, whereas City looks so... And it's a very tangible sense of things having kind of switched slightly. But it was an amazing game, but let's not forget Leicester.
I haven't forgotten them.
I thought Leicester were fantastic, and Nigel Pearson is a great man. And he'd clearly... They'd worked so hard on that game, and the players were so focused and knew exactly what they wanted to do. And it's the good thing about the Premier League. We talk about the top level maybe not being quite there with the top in Spain. Mm. But to have a team come out and play like that against Man United, and apparently the players were a big part of it, saying, we want to attack them, boss, you know, during the week. And they were just fantastic.
Right. And not only did they come out that way, but when they were 3-1 down and 2-0 down, they continued that approach. They maintained that approach.
Doesn't that tell you everything you need to know about the apparent lack of fear factor at Manchester United? I mean, you don't have to go back too far to find when teams literally didn't bother playing them. They'd send their, I think, Wolves and West Brom, to name just two, sent their B teams to play Manchester United because they just didn't even comprehend that they might win. And now you've got a Leicester side who 3-1 down with 30 minutes left just went, sod it, let's go for it. They're there for the taking. And they were there for the taking. As Barney says, they clearly had a plan, which was to get at the fullbacks, get behind the fullbacks. There was an eternity of time and space behind them for them to exploit. And this is a team that's pretty much built up of players found in the lower leagues. There's not many Premier League signings. Even their big summer signing, Ujoa, was $7 million from Brighton. And now you're looking at Manchester United, 5 games. They've played the 3 newly promoted teams and 2 teams who were in a relegation battle last season. So what happens when the big boys come?
Absolutely. As for Leicester, they've played 3 of last season's top 5, plus United in their opening 5 games. Not sure if plus United still counts, but anyway. And they're 7th in the table. Says David Wood, why don't more managers sit in the stands like Nigel Pearson yesterday?
Well, otherwise you wouldn't be able to just rollick your players all the time when they do something wrong, I guess.
Right. But by contrast, you can actually watch a game.
Yeah, when you are... I mean, if you go in the Spurs press book, for example, you're right behind the dugouts and you can't really see a lot.
Right.
And then, you know, if you other places, then you get the whole bird's eye view of it and you see much more of the game. But then again, a lot of managers do seem to have a lot of success by being down on the dugouts.
So, it's pros and cons, isn't it?
Yeah, but Leicester showed remarkable persistence yesterday, which they've done in each of their home games. They've fallen behind against Everton. They were twice behind against Arsenal. They were they conceded the first goal, and they came back in both those games. And yesterday, went 2-0, and it would have been very easy for after that Di Maria goal for them to, you know, which was amazing. Mm. Kind of forgotten now in the madness of everything else that happened afterwards. But it would have been very easy for Leicester to think, "Oh God, there's nothing we can do against this team." You know, they've got two £50 million players up front, and Rooney and Van Persie playing as well. But immediately came back and scored a great goal themselves with Ojoa. It's the fourth goal, I think, he scored now.
Yeah,
for them.
Three of his four Premier League goals have come within 2 minutes of the opposition scoring. Does that tell us something?
Leicester don't give up. Yeah. And he scored some great headers already for them. Both his header against Arsenal and the header on Sunday against United was brilliant.
What about Jamie Vardy, 4 years ago, playing in the seventh tier of English football?
And getting sent off, I think, on that day. I think it was 3 years.
Yeah, the commentators mentioned that. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, he said afterwards it wasn't a foul on Raphael. I think it probably was.
Yeah.
And then I think Raphael probably showed a bit of the naivety that we've come to associate with him by... I don't think... It probably wasn't a penalty, but he kind of did enough to give a dodgy referee an excuse to give something.
Was that because he'd been fouled and he felt hard done by, so he went in and clattered...
A few minutes later, he got clattered by Konchesky, I think, and I was fully expecting Raphael to go into full red mist mode at some point and launch into
Raphael
a tackle.
Raphael did the right thing. He was inside the penalty area. He had to run and put pressure on him. It just wasn't a penalty, but it didn't have any effect on the game. I mean,
okay, because a lot of people have pointed to this as, you know, that bad decision turning the game.
Well, no, I mean, Louis van Gaal didn't think that.
Right.
He's probably in a good position to judge.
Johnny Late does... raise the worrying concept that Clattenburg is now our most senior referee, and it was a pretty bizarre decision, but that in no way mitigates United continuing their worst start.
Referees are always a red herring. I refuse to even know who's refereeing the game or what their history is or anything about that. In fact, mentioning referees should be banned.
All right. Well, pretty sure, Ben, if you could just
just chip out everything I said.
Yep. And all right, so who are we going to point the big finger of United blame at? Is it Wayne Rooney, or to give him his full name, Wayne shouted everyone else when you just headed the ball to an opponent on the edge of your own box, Rooney? I'm quoting you here.
Yeah, well, that was the alarming thing. You look to Rooney for captaincy duties, and there he is dutifully bollocking everybody, but it was his mistake that led to the goal in the first place. It was also Rooney who managed to get himself booked for dissent after Tyler Blackett was sent off for what I think was probably the most obvious penalty in the history of football. Mm. But it's not Rooney's fault. It's not Rocco's fault, as bad as he was. It's just a collective thing. It's a collective arse-going thing when you lose a game that you were 3-1 up with half an hour left.
Right,
I mean, what's wrong with Man United? It's not Wayne Rooney's fault or Louis van Gaal's fault or any of those players' fault. The team was progressively run down over several years. They were very lucky to have Fergie Power still just about keeping them heading towards the shore. And they didn't build from their position of strength. I mean, that's what's wrong. It's very obvious. And
at the same time,
panic buying now is...
£200 million in the last year.
Yes, yeah. But you don't just throw money at a team in that way and hope it's going to work. I don't think the right people are necessarily spending the money as well.
And we go back to the same thing we talked about in the summer, that we talked about the season preview, that we talked about after the transfer window. It's always cake.
All right.
We go back to Vidic, we knew was leaving in about December. Ferdinand, not long after that. That's two of the best centre-backs of the Premier League era leaving.
Vidic still performing at very highest levels as Inter fans, will tell you. But anyway, all right. Well, there are more fun in store. Then who have they got up next, Man United?
West Ham.
West Ham, Jacob. Ooh, we'll talk about those hammers later on. My favourite moment of the game, though, I mean, there were some terrific bits. You mentioned Di Maria's goal. That was delightful. Mm. But the bit when, I think it was 3-3, and Mata receives the ball over, I think it was on the left wing, I'm not sure. Richard Delate just absolutely ran him over. It was extraordinary. You just see this small figure with a ball and a big figure running past him and just continuing running with the ball.
You are wrong, though. The best moment of the game was the three consecutive Leicester nutmegs.
I was going to mention
six seconds.
Astonishing.
Yeah.
when that happened at City, that you could hear, yeah, there was a television on slightly faster feed, and you could just hear this round of jeers and laughter. And there they came, the Nutmegs.
Extraordinary. Extraordinary. All right, well, you raised the question of what happens when they play the big sides. Big sides, perhaps, like Man City and Chelsea, who face each other a little bit later that afternoon at the Etihad in a game which B. Roney describes as pachydermic. What does that mean, Bunny?
It was kind of like a couple of elephants butting each other.
All right, that sounds quite fun.
But it's one of those games where when you're there,
yeah,
you think, oh, this is good. It's really engrossing, and right, you can see very clearly the amount of effort both teams are putting in. You can follow the collisions, and the crowd are very gripped by it. But then you kind of check your Twitter feed at half time, and it's full of people saying, God, this is terrible. Mm. What a terrible game. What negative tactics. I mean, it probably wasn't a televisual feast.
Well, it did have those very poignant scenes involving Frank Lampard.
Yeah, I mean, that was fun, wasn't it? Yeah, he was almost too apologetic afterwards, I thought. I mean, it really was as though he'd scored an own goal, and he was really apologising to his team.
I think in his heart he had, Barney.
Yeah, but it was a classic Lampard finish there, wasn't it? It was great. It was kind of, I mean, he may never score another goal for City. That would be quite fun if he didn't. But does his Chelsea total now go down one? Is he still the record scorer?
Were you excited to see James Milner playing like that?
Milner was great. There was one point where he skinned Eden Hazard and outpaced him, sprinted to the byline, and then sort of kicked the ball out of play. But it was a very exciting moment. He played very well.
All right. How was the post game? Pellegrini getting quite feisty, and then Mourinho in turn. Pellegrini saying Chelsea are a small team who play like Stoke.
Well, I mean, that's just a load of nonsense, isn't it? Twice in a week, I've seen him do some misdirection in his post match press conferences. I mean, either referees are all biased against City, and other teams are biased against City, or teams are playing a certain way, and he hasn't found a set of tactics to cope with that. You know, I don't know which one. There's a sort of pattern there. I mean, he normally just says nothing. He talks in bizarre riddles that you don't understand because he doesn't want to be sat there talking to you. But twice he's come out and spouted a line to distract from the fact that maybe City could have done things slightly differently.
Right, it was four games now without a win.
August the 25th was the last time they won.
Right. And
if teams are playing differently against them, well, you know, that's your job as a manager to work that out.
Right, okay. Yaya Watch?
Well, I mean, I wrote about him in the paper this morning, and I got a lot of, I think, abuse. I just got a vague glimpse of some abuse.
Right.
Because
he basically trolled City fans today in
no,
big paper.
I mean, a lot of people are saying, well, he's still not got over the death of his brother. Leave him alone. Let him get on with playing football. But, you know, I mean, he's still playing for City, and I think he's a bit underrated. He's sort of three players in one, isn't he? He scores goals, but he also does that passing metronome job pretty well, which he did yesterday.
Yeah.
Had a lot of touches, kept the ball.
There's an interesting perspective on that whole Yaya Toure bereavement and some of the comments he's made about cakes and other things over the last year in The Independent today, actually. Herbert. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's someone worth reading on that. It's one of those things. If he has a bad game, people seem a bit uncomfortable with Toure being a great player. I mean, he gets jumped on a lot more than other people if he has a slump in form or this or that. I think he gets a slightly raw deal. I think he's a great player.
Okay, and Vincent Kompany's got a bit of company now with this fellow Mangala.
He was fantastic, yeah. I mean, he's huge. City are huge. They're absolutely vast before kickoff, and he's one of these incredibly athletic, big centre-backs. He's clearly going to have a great career. I mean, he looked brilliant yesterday and really in tune with the Premier League.
All right, but they only got a point at home against Chelsea, admittedly with only 10 men, and that still very much advantaged Chelsea.
I think so, yeah, and Chelsea could have been 3-0 up by the time they scored as well.
All right, then. That's enough for part one, but don't worry, fans of other clubs. Your time is coming. Right after the break, we've got a little bit more on Man United from a Dutch perspective, and then we're going to be talking about crazy events abroad. Oh, hey everyone. Another old friend joins us now on Football Weekly because Mikael Jongsma's on the line from Amsterdam. Are you there in Amsterdam, Mikael?
Yeah, I'm in Amsterdam at the moment.
Super.
Hello
to you. Nice to hear you again. Lots of things I wanted to ask you about the Eredivisie, but hey, first off, how about a quick word on Louis van Gaal? Because I saw you tweeting yesterday the fact that you thought, I think you said something to the effect that it's almost good that he's having a bad start with Man United because it's going to force him to really think his tactics through.
Yeah, I think in his last two managerial jobs with the Dutch national team and with Bayern, he was kind of forced to rethink his tactics because at the Netherlands you had the Kevin Strootman injury and he decided to reshuffle the whole team. And at Bayern, he had quite a bad start as well. And I do think it makes him more inventive.
Right.
When he really has to dig in deep.
How long does this thinking business usually take, then, just for any Man United fans listening?
he said so himself, 10 weeks, I think so.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. But in general, his teams tend to come good, and the main reason he has been sacked or fired from jobs in the past is falling out with iconic people at clubs. So as long as the big names within Manchester United continue to back him, I think things still look good for him and for Manchester United.
I think the 5 goals shipped against Leicester is probably more of an issue.
That's not really flattering.
No. Speaking of Dutch managers, a crazy story and really sad news about Marco van Basten, but I'm a little bit confused now about what's going on with him, his health, and his club. Is it Alkmaar?
Well, Marco van Basten has always been very, very self-demanding as a footballer and afterwards as a coach. And it has always caused him quite some stress. And he joined AZ after quite a good spell at Heerenveen in the Netherlands. And then his father died, who was a huge influence on him. And he took that quite badly. But he kept working. And I think he even drove from the funeral back to the training camp of the club, that kind of stuff. And he was just so uncomfortable with the whole thing. He basically decided that he doesn't want to be a head coach anymore. He feels that it's not the right thing for him. It's not the role that he revels in, and he prefers to work in the shade and just be on the pitch and work with the players. But AZ needed a new head coach, of course, and they started having talks with the assistant manager, a guy called Alex Pastoor, to promote him. Van Basten would become his assistant, which is kind of strange in a way, because Van Basten is such an iconic footballer, and I doubt any of you have heard of Alex Pastoor. Those talks were ended by AZ a few days ago, and they even decided that they wanted Pastoor to leave the club. And the main dispute, according to Pastoor, is that he wanted a 2-year deal as he had as an assistant, while AZ wanted a 9-month deal, still the end of the season. And have talks afterwards on where to go from there. But there have been other stories going around about Alex Pastoor and his agent leaking to the press about Basten's health issues.
So AZ were saying that Pastoor actually leaked the Van Basten health story himself.
Yeah, and Pastoor is a boyhood fan of AZ, so he was very adamant to get the managerial job someday.
Ooh.
And there has been a serious train of thought that he kind of pushed Van Basten, wanted to push Van Basten out of the club.
Wow.
To take up the reign himself.
Wow.
He doesn't come good out of the story at all.
Yeah, no, murky business. All right, in league terms, PSV are still top. They had a big win, or PSV, I probably should say.
PSV, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Ajax are now second. They were involved in the big game with Feyenoord.
Yeah, and luckily it's not only the managerial changes that are spectacular in the Netherlands, it's the games too, because in the first 3 minutes, Feyenoord hit the bar twice. So they were really rampant in the first few minutes, but after 5 minutes they were 1-0 down anyway because of a great Ricardo van Rijn free kick. And within a few minutes after, Feyenoord hit the bar again. So they were really unlucky, and by halftime, Cillessen had faced 8 shots and wasn't forced to make a save at all. So
right. Colin Kazim Richards squandering a big opportunity, I believe.
Yeah, I thought his effort was the second one to hit the bar as well.
Ah, right, okay.
Well, he did look quite good, but he doesn't look like a striker, even though he claims he is.
All right.
That's the main problem for Feyenoord, actually. I think, in general, Feyenoord have had a kind of a rough summer with Graziano Pella leaving, Ronald Koeman leaving, who are both living it up in Southampton at the moment. And some other players as well, and they have a big rebuilding job to do. And to be fair, they looked really good. They completely packed Ajax back. Since Opta started collecting this type of data. Ajax have never had so less possession in a game. Yeah, Ajax only had, I think, about 36 or 37% of possession. And they tend to dominate matches. So Feyenoord were rampant, and they were just very unlucky that they didn't have a very good goal scorer leading the line.
Mikael Jungsberg. Hey, continental football's great, isn't it, Jacob?
Yes, good.
Did you see what happened in Spain at the weekend?
Yes.
Real Madrid and Barcelona just had big wins.
What was the Barcelona score in the end?
I think it was 5-0, wasn't it? Oh,
okay.
Whereas Real Madrid had beaten Deportivo La Coruña 8-2. Cristiano got his 22nd hat-trick since he started playing in top flight.
There are a lot of people eulogising his... a lot of praise for his neck muscles, apparently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, apparently he was a very good header. He's good at that.
Well, he is, isn't he?
His neck muscles are astonishing, aren't they?
I mean, he's always had a very big neck, hasn't he?
I think he's worked at it. I mean, you need to work to get a neck that big.
I mean, I'm not sure how you get a neck that big. I'm not sure what you would do.
There's
to get a neck
machines
that, big.
That will.
Yeah, I've never sort of come across that.
Right.
I think it was collars, like you used to see in National Geographic, special metal collars extend your neck.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, like the tribes people sometimes do. They put those rings around.
I've never seen anyone in the gym working
almost
on their
as
neck.
Almost as exciting. You don't go to that kind of gym.
Interestingly, I think I think it was Tacitus who said.
Hiya.
All great men don't have necks.
Right. Was he the least nominative, determinatively named person ever, given that there's all these quotes from him around?
Quite possibly.
And his name is Tacitus.
Well, he probably had a short neck. The idea is that it's all about the balance of the heart and the head.
Oh, yeah?
And the neck is what separates the soul, you know, the instinct from the intellect.
Head and heart, right.
And so the shorter your neck, the more in touch with both parts of your being you are.
Really? Former England cricket player Gladstone Smith.
Yeah, a great man.
Deserves
a great man. Yeah.
Anyway... almost as amazing as Cristiano Ronaldo scoring his 22nd hat-trick was the fact that Chicharito grabbed a brace. Chicharito.
Yeah, he got the last two, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, but it was kind of... Yeah. The die was already cast by then. Anyway, Atletico only managed to draw at home to Celta Vigo. In Scotland, Dundee United won the Dundee Classico. Oh, away at Dens Park 4-1. They are now top of the Premiership. They're 5 points clear of Celtic, who are in fourth place. Pow. That doesn't quite count as abroad football, actually, but we'll include it. Germany. Do you know who's top in Germany? Do you, Ian?
I do.
Who is it?
It's Paderborn.
And where were they 12 months ago?
Oh, I'd say about 16th in the second division.
That's true. What an incredible rise. It's Leicester-esque. It's maybe even more dramatic than Leicester. They're on top, and they got there with this 2-0 win over Hannover, which featured, do you know what, Ian?
No.
An 83-yard goal.
Get out.
Yeah, Stoppenkamp, I think his name is Stoppenkamp. He collects the ball just outside his own area and looks around, sees the keeper off his line and wallops it downfield and in it goes. It's the longest goal ever in Bundesliga history. I'm not sure if it's the longest because you know, goalkeepers often score goals.
Yeah.
Begovic scored.
Somebody scored one against Ben Foster.
Paul Robinson did. Yeah,
free kick.
Yeah, against Ben Foster. That was him, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's the longest I've seen from a dead ball.
But I think, yeah, that's the thing. I think goalkeepers shouldn't count. This is an outfield player. I can't believe anyone scored a longer goal than
that. Was it the last second and the goal he was trying to score?
The goalkeeper was certainly off his line. They were already 1-0 up, so I guess Hannover might have only seen the highlights, so I don't know quite how the thing evolved. But it was amazing. So there they are. They're top of the Bundesliga.
Do you remember Xabi Alonso scoring that one for Liverpool?
Mm.
I remember seeing a TV programme about that. Cool. Where there was a guy, a kind of Liverpool fan, who'd had a dream that Xabi Alonso was going to do that.
That's
and put a bet on it.
No.
I put a bet on it, and then he did. And he won the bet, which is proof of paranormal forces.
Absolutely. If you were in any lingering doubt, listeners, that just happened. they're going to be playing Bayern Munich next. Paderborn.
Bayern Munich, who somehow managed not to beat Hamburg.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another crazy story, isn't it? Hamburg, they appoint a new manager and boom, he gets it. Well, they're putting it down to that Euro hangover, which has been a bit of an issue.
Apparently Neuer was booked for handball on the halfway line.
Yeah, he was. And there's a strong case for saying he should have been sent off because was he the last man preventing a goal-scoring opportunity? He'd run pretty much the halfway line and then he was forced to handle because he was getting... He fell over as he went in to make the challenges. Anyway, speaking of German keepers in trouble, have you seen the incredible Tim Wieser story? Since retiring, he has hit the weights, and I don't know your neck business, but he is absolutely huge. It looks like one of those doctored photos. And he insists that he's got an offer from WWE to go and become a pro wrestler. I'm not a wrestling follower myself, but are there any other Bundesliga stars there?
You couldn't have scripted it, could you?
I couldn't have, no. No, that's what's happening in Germany. In France, PSG are down in fifth. Olympique Marseille under Marcelo Bielsa. They had a terrible season last time around. He's really turned it around. They have four straight wins. They're top of the table. PSG, meanwhile, all sorts of talk that there's a really nasty rift in the locker room after Ibra's been calling out his teammates about about waking up and stuff. They've had three straight draws, and they drew with Lyon Sunday night. Lyon, who've had abject start. I know they're a big name, but they've had a rotten start to the season. They were put out of the Europa League preliminaries by Astra. Astra. They're from Romania, you know, I think. Anyway, just time to tell you that in Italy, Saturday night saw Juve beat Milan 1-0 in one of those top-of-the-table type encounters. Napoli Sunday afternoon lost away at Udinese. Rafa Benitez alert. There's all sorts of ill feeling down there and the finger of blame being pointed at the owner so far, but I think it could be swinging Rafawards very shortly. Roma stay on top ahead of Juve on goal difference because they beat Cagliari just 2-0. A lot of people expected more goals in this one, but just 2-0. The first goal from Matteo Destro, the second one from a young fella called Florenzi, who hadn't scored for 6 months. What did he do to celebrate?
Is this the chap I saw pictures of on Twitter kissing his grandmother?
He kissed his grandmother. The thing was, his grandmother was sitting some way up in the stands. I don't know if you remember Pat Cash at Wimbledon climbing up into the rafters to greet his girlfriend, I suspect. Florenzi did similar. I mean, at the Olimpico, you got the pitch, and then you got, it being an Italian stadium, a large running track. And then you got a moat, and then some kind of glass panels and stuff. So he gets past all of those. Then he gets in, and he starts making his way up the terraces to where his granny sat, and he gives her a big hug.
Was he booked for that?
Oh, of course. Of course he was booked.
Good.
It's the kind of thing, nobody likes to see that kind of thing.
That Pat Cash thing, I saw him later that day when he won Wimbledon in southwest London.
Right.
Well, I saw his head lean out of a car. And I heard him say, get a couple of lagers too.
Well, he was certainly going to celebrate that Wimbledon win.
I touched his moment of glory there.
Right.
He wasn't wearing his headband.
Okay, but it was him, certainly. Yeah.
Definitely him, yeah.
Okay. Hey, I can't believe we've talked about goal celebrations and not mentioned Joel of Curitiba. You must have seen this viral social media clip. No? He scores, I believe it's against Sao Paulo. This is middle of last week.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Runs, leaps over the advertising hoardings, little realising that on the other side there's stairs going down. We're all laughing, but there's precious little funny about the 6 foot plunge he made down towards the locker rooms. And while all the stewards are seeing him and going, no, stop. But of course, by then he's midair and he's doing that kind of Wile E. Coyote off a cliff business. Ian, I believe you had a question about Italian football.
Yes, well, I normally watch your BT roundup on a Monday morning.
Oh, yeah.
You see, so I'm completely in the dark. How did Nemanja Vidic do this weekend?
It's funny you should ask that. His career so far at Inter has involved first game, concedes a penalty, gets a red card, gets suspended, now comes back for the third game, gifts the ball to the opposition who promptly score, and then he did have a goal himself, which was then disallowed. So it's not been good.
Really. Not well.
Not that good, really. All right, here's a couple of posts. Gabriel 55. A lot of abusive posts this week. I don't know what's that about. Gabriel 55, you need to work on your Italian, chum, especially if you're going to be rude about people. John Downey says, Jesus wept. That's a great way to begin a post, isn't it? Jesus wept. What's he so upset about? Biffo and Inter Jim, that's me and Barry, said they didn't know about the offside flag indicators. Did you know that when the linesman flags for offside, he points one... You know this, Ian.
He presses a button and a little buzzer goes off on the referee.
No, not that. It's the angle of his arm indicates on what side of the field the offside occurred.
I never knew that.
All right, you enter the roll call of shame.
Why is Barry called
Biffo? I'm more interested in Biffo.
Well, that's Barry, I think.
Yeah, but why?
But who says he's Biffo?
Well, that's John Downey. We weren't sure if the Russian league had started yet. Yes, it bleeding well did, says John Downey, who is well up on the facts. Everyone knows they changed the season structure a couple of years back. How can football journalists not know these basic facts? I might as well listen to Shearer and Savage. He very welcome to, John.
But they did change it before the Euros, didn't they? And it meant that they'd played something like a double season before Euro 2012, or a season and a half.
You're not helping.
So
you,
they were
bud.
All incredibly knackered when they got there.
All right, well, we're sorry to disappoint, John. And, of course, we're going to try harder and enjoy Shearer and Savage. Cool Dog 1984 wants to talk about our failure to mention Coventry City's return to the Ricoh Arena. Has it got anything to do with blah, 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 legal action, etc.? No, we did mention it. We did, actually. And we were delighted about it, and we all said how happy we were. He says, although I'm happy to be back at the Ricoh, I fear there is still a long way to go with the revelation that Wasps are in talks to buy a majority share in the stadium. I don't know, does he mean the insect genus?
Yeah, wasps are really annoying, aren't they?
They are.
Buzzing around.
They are.
Now they want to buy football stadiums. Do you know wasps are a rare example of a pointless animal, aren't they?
What way? They have a point.
They don't do anything.
Do they not?
No, I don't think so. Although I think
they must form some.
Well, some people claim that they pollinate,
bee, is it?
But I think that the male wasp in particular has no function. It has no behaviour.
Because that's usually it. They eat something and keep the numbers down.
Aphids or something, probably.
No, this is what they don't do.
Maybe
they're rare in that.
Exist to kind of keep football stadiums in business or something. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Well, it's good to see wasps finally doing something with
finding a function
after all these
hooray for wasps
thousands of years.
Okay. Ross Charles says, after the Felix Maggot use of cheese, any other strange injury medicines? None stranger than that, I'll warrant. Mm. That was a great story for anyone who hasn't heard it, Jacob.
Felix Maggot has now gone from Fulham, but they lost anyway.
It was Brett Hangeland, though.
Yeah. They lost anyway on the weekend with Kit Simons now in charge. Yeah. Lost to Blackburn at home. But anyway, he... when Hangeland was injured last season, he was on the treatment table and... Hangeland sent either the club doctor or a flunky out to get to the local Tesco's to get a slab of cheese and said, just sit on that.
Well, I often, when things haven't gone well, when I have a bit of cheese between two bits of bread, that's...
but Maggot has been out this morning saying... people in England aren't ready to embrace German methods.
This is what made them world champions.
Yep.
It's not entirely without precedent, though, is it?
What, because, the cheese business?
Well, you put a steak on a black eye, don't
you?
So it's just working through the fridge.
Oh, I see, yeah. I don't know.
I'm not saying it works or anything, but a horse placenta?
Yeah.
That just sounds pretty weird.
It does, doesn't it, actually? Okay. Good. Here's a little bit of music and then, or an advert, and then we'll be back with more really exciting stuff from the Premier League this weekend.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
Shuffle paper. Jacob, you're blinking like you're struggling with this.
Just gearing up.
I'm going to throw something your way. Boom, West Ham, Liverpool.
Yeah.
You know, you've always been Big Sam's biggest fan. Vindication for Jacob Steinberg.
Are you saying that ironically or...
Sarcastically.
No, I'm actually someone who's been on Big Sam's side as much as it's possible to be. A lot of people don't like him, but I think that he's, he's all right in some of the things that he does.
You know what? I said you were his biggest fan. I'm wrong. He's actually his biggest fan.
He is his biggest fan. But apparently he wasn't... I wasn't working at the game on Saturday. But those who were there said that he wasn't as full of self-praise as he usually is after a win.
Our high pressing was the root of that. We played outstandingly well.
Right, but it wasn't the... When he cracked up after holding Chelsea to a 0-0 draw and said, I don't give a shite. We've out-tacticked him and he can't take it, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't all that.
Which
but
is fair enough.
Allardyce gets a lot of stick for being one-dimensional and very predictable with the way that the team's set up. And, you know, there's a lot of angst in the summer when Carroll was injured and then people wondering how exactly an Allardyce team is going to function without its big man up front. And then he loses Nolan before the second game, the main source of goals for the first 3 years of his tenure. And
has he been there 3 years?
This is his fourth season, yeah.
Wow.
I know, time does fly when you're watching Sam Allardyce. but he's actually, in the last two games, he's shown an ability to adapt to the losing, you know, the way that he normally sets up a team. They the way they set up on Saturday is actually, you know, pretty commendable. And against Hull as well last week, he had this time Zarate dropped out and Song and Kiyate and Noble playing in the middle, Noble kind of shielding and Song and Kiyate allowed to kind of roam a little bit. And then there was no one up front, really. They played ostensibly two strikers in Valencia and Sacco, but they weren't through the middle. They were, both of them were stationed out wide, kind of high and coming inside using the pace. And Stuart Downing has been moved to, you know, now this playmaking maestro.
Yeah.
You know, previously he'd always been playing for West Ham on the right or the left.
See, at the and sharp end of the diamond.
Cutting inside and crossing to nobody, because that was the way that, you know, it was very blunt. That was what you thought Allardyce, the only way that Allardyce knew how to play. Instead, they've suddenly just started playing very good passing football through the middle with two strikers on out wide who can run and are quick and have a bit of quality.
So James Van Praag raises a salient point. He says, how will Big Sam deal with the return of club captain Nolan, talisman Carroll? Well,
that's what everybody was saying.
When, and £10 million Jarvis.
That's, well, I don't think Jarvis will play, but that, you know, Nolan is his favourite. He's the club captain, and he is well respected within the club. A lot of fans don't like him and think they, you know, Allardyce, he just picks him all the time. And I personally don't see how he would get back into that particular side, but it's, you know, at the same time, it's two games of playing like that. You know, teams do find a way to combat styles eventually. You know, it's people aren't expecting this from West Ham at the moment.
So
it's good
options.
To have different. It's good to have different ways of playing, and also you can't rely on Carroll as well to be fit.
Yeah, I think you're probably safe with Andy Carroll. The problem of him being fit and insisting on being probably all right.
But, that was the best they played under Allardyce. You know. Forget the Tottenham game last year, and when they beat Chelsea, it was a proper performance. You know, they completely outplayed Liverpool.
Right. I mean, Alex Song coming in, and Valencia was terrific. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
They had that little wobble when Rodgers changed it to, when he changed his formation to 3-5-2, and they got Sterling out wide. But then after that, they were still the better team. And although Liverpool had a lot of pressure in the second half, they are not what they were last season. I always think when you look at a game and you sort of come to it as an opposing fan, you look at a team and who's going to hurt you in that side, and you look at through their lineup. Last season, when they came to Upton Park, they had Suarez and Sturridge up front. This time they came and they had Balotelli and Barini. Mm. It's just not the same.
And at the back?
Dreadful.
Disastrous.
Yeah, I mean, they had to... they were caught cold for the first goal of a set piece again, and... the second goal, you know, they weren't able to deal with that high pressure intensity from West Ham. I'm not sure I don't know if it was a chip or if he meant it, or a cross from Sacco. But then they had to bring off Manquillo. They could have brought off any of them, and they brought on Sacco, who was Mamadou Sacco, who was as much a disaster. Knocked out his own teammate at one point. Lovren. No one seems to know what those concussion rules are about, because Lovren was down for a very long time.
Right.
Eventually, just they had about two stretchers on at one point.
It was that bad an injury?
And then he had his head strapped up and continued. But then Sacco gave away the third goal as well.
Right.
So, you know, defensively they are a shambles at the moment.
Liverpool. Well, they're playing the derby next, aren't they? Yeah. The early kickoff on Saturday.
Well, he's got a week to prepare for that now, isn't he? I mean, I thought it was quite interesting listening to Brendan afterwards, because, you know, first of all, he said, no, it's not to do with the Champions League. We're delighted to be back at the cutting edge. And then he said exactly the opposite and said, yeah, we don't have much time to prepare. I mean, the Liverpool success last season was all about his brilliant fine-tuning of his team. You know, they'd emerge with a surprising slight rejig in attack, which they'd blow teams away in the first 30 minutes while the other manager's trying to work out what they're doing, something they've worked on all week. And he's clearly struggling with it. I mean, that's part of the reason why I think Big Sam enjoyed gloating so much. And I think we all quite enjoy Big Sam gloating. Because he had out-tacticked him. And it was kind of, there you go, young lad, you know. And you know, it's part of the skill of managing. I mean, Brendan will have to work out how to get his team running almost without him. Two games a week, just keep going along.
Well,
I mean,
you should write a book
on managers. When they did try to change it up, Liverpool, when they brought on Lambert, you know, supposedly, you know, Lambert's not just a big lump. He's got a good touch, but he was there... Immediately, Allardyce brought on James Collins and went to three at the back. And straight away, Liverpool had a corner, and they brought on Lambert for it. And Allardyce went right Collins on, and you know, that was 15 minutes to go. And I thought Balotelli was poor in his early days, but he was very static. didn't do much, wasn't a lot of movement. And you can kind of tell as well, he's doing his very best to behave.
Yeah. Right.
He was booked for that stupid
Adrian thing, yeah.
I think it was one point where he got, there was a foul against him, and you could tell he really wanted to just boot the ball away. And he had to really hold himself back, I think.
Oh, and, poor chap. Everton, anyway, they lost as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
At home to Palace again, Ian.
Straight after a Europa League game, which is what we were talking about on Thursday.
Yeah. Hey, did you know that in all the top European leagues, and I'm going to include Ligue 1 in that, only Evian have conceded more goals than Everton?
Tim Howard has not had a good return to club football.
Ask you. Yeah, right.
Because he was directly culpable for two goals yesterday. One, a penalty that he gave away by pretty much just crouching down in front of James McArthur and tripping him up. Mm. And the second for flapping it across. But that's off the back of shipping six against Chelsea.
Yep.
After which he should have been sent off after about 10 minutes for claiming the ball outside the area. So I'm not sure what's happened there. But
so is it that, or is it that the kind of the residue of Moyes football has now worn off at Everton and we're now seeing the real Martinez?
No, I think there's probably a combination of raised expectations, a few people with World Cup hangover, well, Tim Howard with a World Cup hangover. But I do think the Europa League issue is still right there. Martinez is absolutely adamant they're going to go for it in that competition and it won't have an effect on the league. But
they've got the League Cup this midweek. They're going to be at Swansea. Crystal Palace, we should say, wow, Crystal Palace, good on you, Neil Warnock. They're going to be playing Newcastle in the League Cup.
Just in defence of Tim Howard, he was brilliant in midweek. He had one of those games.
Against Wolfsburg?
Yeah, he made hundreds of saves.
Yeah, the Premier League side that beat a German club.
It could have quite easily been 5-4 the other way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the last half an hour was...
Had Tim Howard not been between the sticks.
Yeah, he did one of his Tim Howard games. Where
is it just the Premier League's now just too... It's small beer for him after his exploits in Brazil.
If he doesn't get a message from the president, he just can't...
Yeah, can't. Perhaps, I don't know.
Palace have gone three games unbeaten now.
Under Warnock?
Three times in both their last two away games as well.
Right.
But, you know.
All right, super. Well, Newcastle will be up next for Palace in the League Cup. They drew 2-2 at home to Hull. A fairly entertaining game, was it? And he's still at work, Alan Pardew?
Yeah, no signs that he's not late good. Tactical shift from Alan Pardew saves the day.
There you go.
Which I'm sure went down well.
QPR drew with Stoke. Paul Doyle pointing out today they might want to wait before pushing for a 40,000 stadium QPR. You know, because their future is anything but certain at the moment, although they're not bottom of the table. That's Newcastle still. Saints won at Swansea. Poor, that was a result, wasn't it? 1-0. Victor Wanyama.
Yeah, I think that must be his first goal.
It is, because it's the first ever Kenyan goal in the Premier League, and he's always been Kenyan. So
he has always been Kenyan.
He's always been Kenyan. So
they're up to second, Southampton.
That's ridiculous.
Above high-flying Aston Villa.
I mean, it's not ridiculous. Clearly Southampton fans.
And a game notable for Wilfred Bony, unleashing a primal scream, primal howl, and then hitting Yoshida like a train.
Right.
That was, that's one way to contest the ball.
Okay. Anyway, we haven't talked about two big London clubs on a collision course next weekend, because it's the North London Derby. And one of them has just been beaten at home by West Brom, and the other's just gone away and beaten the other Premier League Birmingham-based side, Aston Villa. Which one are we going to talk about first?
Well, it was interesting to see Mesut Ozil
in the
central position that he's craved and indeed demanded.
It's a really interesting story, but does it mean anything given what had happened to Villa's squad before this game?
No, it doesn't mean anything at all, because this is what Arsenal do. They win these games. They
answer criticism that wasn't directed at them, basically.
Well, Villa's squad, you were asking what had happened to them.
Yeah.
Yeah, had been ravaged by an appalling intestinal virus, which led to Weisman coming off at half-time vomiting.
Well, first they lost Darren Bent and Nathan Baker before the game, along with a number of coaching staff. Brad Guzman had had it, Fabian Delford had it. Mm. 15 minutes before kickoff, we were told that Ashley Westwood had withdrawn, he had it. At half-time, as Weisman came off the pitch, he was vomiting up against the side of the tunnel.
Oh.
So it was right the way through the squad.
Mm.
But alarmingly, it didn't seem to affect them as much in the first half an hour. They're very much the better team. Every Arsenal player appeared to have a match losing mistake in him. Villa had two excellent chances to score. One, unsurprisingly, from a set piece when Kieran Clarke's header was saved by Chesney, and another after a Chesney
poor goal kick. And it really was, after half an hour, the mood in Villa Park was amazing. It was practically a full house. The fans were in strong voice. Mm. Everything was transformed. And then 3 minutes later, well, again, everything was transformed, but very much for the negative from Villa.
Yeah, that was that remarkable thing from Mesut Ozil, a goal scored, a goal assisted. Now, is this him playing in his proper position? Because that was a question that was being raised.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, why would you have him on the left where there are defensive responsibilities there?
Right.
And that's not what he's good at, and he'll let you down.
So he should play kind of in the hole behind the striker?
If he's going to play at all, he right. should play in the centre.
Ozil wants to play in the middle, and this is Arsene Wenger now, so... But I can show you 10 players in my squad who want to play in the middle. Well, you shouldn't have bought them all then, should you, Arsene?
It's a very good point. Isn't Arsenal brilliant? I mean, talking about City having this kind of hierarchy of people where, you know, obviously at City you need three ticks before you sign a player.
Everyone's, right.
Arsenal is a dictatorship. It's a Napoleonic system. It's whatever I say goes.
Well,
so if there were two people actually really having a say here, you would not have this ludicrous imbalance of creative players. Someone would say, look... Sorry, you've got to buy...
The real problem now is that if they do play Ozil as number 10, and I agree, I think they should, there's only room for two people behind him. So from Wilshere, Ramsey, Arteta, and that forlorn hope that Arsenal fans have of having a proper defensive midfielder.
Mm.
So someone's going to have to pay the price. On Saturday, it was Wilshere who was left out.
Because you'd have him in the middle, and you'd have, what, one on either side, would you?
One on either side and two behind.
Two behind, that would be a midfield five.
Essentially,
yeah, okay.
Well, 4-2-3-1, it was widely described as.
Okay.
But who drops out? And who does the tackling?
I don't know.
No one does.
At this point, you meant to start talking about William Carvalho, aren't you? Does he exist? Is he really?
He's the defensive midfielder du jour.
Yeah, I mean, because I don't remember him at the World Cup either. I mean, he's kind of
he played
the answer to everything.
Times, I think.
But it's like Leandro Damião was linked with Spurs for years and years, and then I never actually saw him play.
No, Yamavia.
Yamavia
was the one that everybody wanted.
He exists.
He's now in Italy, isn't
he's at Inter. They play Saints in the Cup, then they got the North London Derby against Spurs. Are we going to finish off our show with Spurs? One shot on target at home to West Brom. What happened? Now, I know that, I think Pochettino made reference to the club's traditional problems after European fixtures, but
yeah.
I know I'm not alone in mentioning the fact that he made 10 changes from the game away at Partizan Belgrade. Only Hugo Lloris, the keeper, stayed in the final.
Kind of irrelevant, that one.
Yeah.
I mean, it really affected them badly last year, but what also was a problem they had under ABB, and particularly was, you know, when teams come and are hard to break down at White Hart Lane, they do tend to lack some incision at times. And Alan Irvine, much maligned, of course, but you know, probably feeling pretty chipper this morning, said yesterday that they were playing on the atmosphere at White Hart Lane, which of course AVB got into hot water for mentioning
right.
last year.
Yeah.
At the same time, Pochettino had this at Southampton where. There were some really good performances against big sides, which actually we haven't seen from Spurs yet. But when he was in his early days, he struggled against. You know, they lost. I remember them losing to QPR.
Yeah.
They lost to West Brom.
No, it's a very fair point.
Draw with Sunderland, and
you called Alan Irvine much maligned. I thought there was a certain amount of residual goodwill to him, not only because he's Greg Bukowski's former. Manager, also because he just looks like a sound bloke. Yeah, I particularly like your observation, I think it was you, Ian, over the weekend, it can only have been you, that he looks like you imagined Damon Hill would grow up to be, whereas Damon Hill's grown up to look like a wizard.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. So it's very, very perturbing. But I don't think he's particularly popular with West Brom fans, or certainly not with West Brom fans who contact me.
Because of his football, or because they were expecting somebody bigger in the
I think
role?
They were expecting someone who might have managed at that level before, and if they had managed a level below, might have made a decent fist of it, which of course he hadn't done, but he is in position. He hasn't made a great start, but this was a very, very surprising result. What I thought was interesting was, as Jacob was saying earlier, the press box at White Hart Lane is right behind the bench.
Mm-hmm.
So often you see more of the interaction with the managers and the coaches than you do the players. And apparently Pochettino was throwing his water bottle to the ground and screaming, "Wake up, wake up," through the early stages of the game.
At his water bottle?
Yeah.
Really?
Very demanding.
But that's why everyone went on about the gilet chucking incident, wasn't it? Because it was pretty much the only thing you could see from the press box.
Tim Sherwood.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Or they might want to address that in their new stadium when they build that.
Yeah, in a few years' time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay, well, I'm already looking forward to next weekend. Football, eh? It's relentless. Excellent. Many thanks, Barney, for explaining the last few days to us. And you, Ian McIntosh. And you, Jacob Steinberg. And you, producer Ben, for snipping out all the bits that were too dull to make it for the listeners' pleasure. Listeners, we'll be back on Thursday. Make sure you're there too. And we'll have a Football Weekly Extra. Till then, bye-bye.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.